I think we all have a pretty fixed idea of a car dealership, right? Those sprawling lots, the gleaming rows of vehicles, maybe that familiar negotiation process or, you know, the hum of the service bay. But after really digging into our sources, what's happening behind those showrooms in the North American auto industry is far more complex and rapidly transforming than I ever realized. It's truly a critical moment for them. Today, we're taking a deep dive into exactly that. The North American auto dealership sector. It's an industry that's been around for, well, over a century, providing the primary way we buy and service our vehicles. But as our source material reveals, it's undergoing profound transformation.
That's right. Our insights today come from a really comprehensive investment research report, the North American Auto Dealership Sector. This report offers a detailed and really insightful look at the financial and operational dynamics that shape how cars are bought and sold across the continent, from the big publicly traded groups down to the, you know, the independent local dealer.
Our mission today is to unpack this dense material, extract the most crucial nuggets of knowledge, and give you a shortcut to understanding an industry that impacts millions of consumers, including you. We'll uncover its hidden strengths, the seismic shifts it's undergoing, and what these changes could mean for your next vehicle purchase or service experience. So, let's get started. All right, to kick us off, the report leads with a pretty striking description, calling the North American auto dealership industry mature and inherently cyclical, and standing at a critical juncture. Here, what does that really mean for how we should view this sector from the outset?
It means we're looking at a sector with deeply established roots, one that reliably follows the broader economic ups and downs, but it's now at a turning point, a really significant one. It's facing significant, almost unprecedented pressures that could fundamentally change its structure. The most foundational element to understand, and arguably its primary competitive advantage, is what the report terms the regulatory moat.
Okay, the regulatory moat.
This refers specifically to state franchise laws, which are present in all 50 U.S. states. These laws largely prohibit vehicle manufacturers, or OEMs, that's your Ford, your Toyota, your GM, from selling directly to consumers.
Okay.
So for the most part, you can't just walk into a Toyota factory and drive off with a new Camry. You go to a Toyota dealership. This legal framework has been in place for nearly a century, and it has historically insulated dealers from disintermediation, meaning it prevents manufacturers from bypassing them entirely. It's fostered a stable, though a highly fragmented, competitive environment.
So this regulatory moat isn't just some legal loophole. It's the bedrock of the entire auto retail system. It means manufacturers are essentially locked into this century-old distribution method. What's fascinating is how, ironically, this can create fierce intra-brand competition among dealers, like multiple Ford dealerships fighting for your business, often leading to better deals for you. It's a fascinating paradox, a protective barrier for dealers that still manages to benefit consumers. Within this unique framework, the report points to consolidation as a major bullish thesis for the sector. Why is that such a powerful force right now?
Well, consolidation is powerful because it allows these larger publicly traded dealership groups to leverage their superior access to capital. They're able to acquire smaller, often independent operators at what we call accretive multiples.
Accretive multiples, meaning the purchase itself boosts their earnings.
Exactly. Imagine a big company buying a profitable mom-and-pop store, and that store's earnings immediately boost the big company's financial performance so much that it lifts their own earnings per share. It's like getting a bonus just for buying something. These larger groups also bring sophisticated operational platforms and achieve significant economies of scale. For instance, they can centralize back office functions like HR, IT, and even marketing across dozens, sometimes hundreds of locations, massively reducing overhead. It's about efficiency.
Makes sense.
But it's not just M&A-driven growth that makes these large groups attractive. The report highlights dealers' highly diversified revenue streams, specifically their parts and service, P&S, and finance and insurance, F&I segments. These aren't just add-ons. They are described as highly profitable and crucially less cyclical components of the business.
Less cyclical. So more stable.
Precisely. They provide stable cash flows that act as a crucial ballast, mitigating the extreme volatility of new and used vehicle sales, especially during economic downturns when consumers might hold onto their cars longer and invest more in maintenance. These segments really shine. They become even more important.
So the picture so far for dealers sounds pretty solid. Regulatory protection, consolidation benefits, almost too good to be true, perhaps. Because while these are strong tailwinds, the report quickly pivots to some pretty serious bearish headwinds, long-term secular threats that could fundamentally shake things up. What are the biggest storm clouds gathering on this industry's horizon?
Well, the first major threat is the accelerating transition to electric vehicles, or EVs. The report explains that EVs pose a fundamental risk to that lucrative P&S business we just discussed.
Why is that?
Because EVs require substantially less routine maintenance than traditional internal combustion engine, or ICE vehicles. Things like oil changes, spark plug replacements, complex exhaust system repairs. They simply don't exist for EVs. That whole category of work just disappears. This is a core concern for investors because P&S is such a stable and high-margin segment that has historically balanced out the more volatile vehicle sales. It's a big chunk of reliable profit potentially at risk.
Okay, EVs are one. What else?
Then there's the challenge from the original equipment manufacturers themselves, the OEMs. They've been inspired by direct-to-consumer DTC pioneers like Tesla, which have shown you can sell cars without a traditional dealer network. So legacy OEMs are investing heavily in digital retail capabilities. They're also experimenting with new business models like the agency model.
The agency model, how does that work?
We'll dive into it more later, but essentially it shifts the dealer from a reseller to an agent. This model threatens to erode the dealer's traditional role and potentially squeeze profit margins over time by giving the OEM more control over pricing and the customer relationship.
Mm. More control for the manufacturer.
Definitely. And finally, there's the more immediate pressure. The current cycle is in a downswing after a period of unprecedented profitability.
Yeah, I mean, who doesn't remember those crazy times during the pandemic when there were virtually no cars on lots and prices were through the roof?
Exactly. That was fueled by severe inventory shortages. Now, the normalization of vehicle supply means more cars are available, but that comes hand in hand with a higher interest rate environment. This combination exerts sustained pressure on vehicle gross margins and significantly increases inventory carrying costs for dealers, impacting their bottom line right now. It's a tougher operating environment.
It sounds like a truly complex balancing act, navigating both immediate and long-term challenges. So with all these forces at play, what does the report suggest ultimately determines success for the publicly traded dealership groups? Who wins in this environment?
It truly comes down to really sharp strategic and operational execution. It's not just about having dealerships, it's about running them exceptionally well. Firstly, the ability to pursue a disciplined acquisition strategy is paramount. It's not just about buying dealerships, but buying the right ones at the right price, ensuring they integrate seamlessly into the existing network.
So smart shopping, basically.
Smart shopping and smart integration, yes. Secondly, they must be effective at integrating new stores and extracting synergies from those acquisitions. You can buy all you want, but if you can't make them work together efficiently, optimize their processes, and leverage shared resources, it's a wasted effort. The real value comes after the deal closes.
Right.
Thirdly, they need to continuously optimize those high-margin P&S and F&I segments. This is especially crucial as they navigate the challenges and opportunities presented by the EV transition, finding new ways to generate service revenue even if traditional maintenance declines. They have to adapt that profit center.
And the bottom line.
And the definitive measure of long-term value creation, according to the report, is generating robust through-cycle free cash flow to fund both acquisitive growth and shareholder returns. In essence, it's about consistently making money that they can reinvest wisely in growth or return to their shareholders, regardless of economic ups and downs. That consistency is key. That's what investors ultimately reward.
We've touched on the broad strokes, but now let's zoom in on the very DNA of this industry, its market structure. What are the sheer dimensions of this sector? And more importantly, how do its unique foundational elements truly set the stage for everything else we'll discuss? Let's start with those market size numbers.
Absolutely. The U.S. auto dealership market alone was valued at approximately $257.30 billion in 2024. That's a huge number.
Quarter of a trillion, roughly. Wow.
Yeah, and projections indicate a compound annual growth rate, or CAGR, of around 4% through 2031. And if we look even wider, the entire North American automotive market, which includes manufacturing and related services, was over $535.7 billion in 2023, with a 5.0% CAGR forecast.
So big numbers, but that growth rate, 4 or 5%. Sounds pretty moderate.
Exactly. What this really tells us is that this is a mature, stable, but also a slow-growing market. This means that significant growth for individual dealership groups isn't going to come from organic market expansion. The overall pie isn't growing that fast. Instead, their growth has to come from capturing market share from competitors. It's essentially a zero-sum game of taking business from someone else.
And we talked about that powerful competitive advantage earlier, the regulatory moat. You mentioned it being truly unique. Can you deepen our understanding of these state franchise laws and how they provide this narrow economic moat?
Yeah, this is truly unique to the U.S. automotive retail sector. All 50 U.S. states have these comprehensive laws governing the manufacturer-dealer relationships. They are described as a powerful barrier to entry, effectively preventing OEMs from selling new vehicles directly to consumers in most jurisdictions. This creates what the report calls a narrow economic moat for dealers, insulating them from direct competition with the very companies that supply their product. It's a legal shield.
And you said it benefits consumers too. How?
Well, because for you, the consumer, this system actually creates intra-brand price competition. That means if you're looking for a new Ford, multiple Ford dealers in your area will compete against each other for your business, often leading to better pricing and financing options. So while it protects the dealer, it also fosters competition that benefits the buyer.
Okay, that makes sense.
And for the manufacturers, it provides a capital-light distribution and service network. Think about it. Local dealers have collectively invested over $200 billion in physical infrastructure, the showrooms, the service centers, the parts departments.
$200 billion with a B.
Yes. So the manufacturers don't have to bear that enormous upfront cost. It's a massive ready-made network that essentially costs the OEM nothing to build or maintain directly. They leverage the dealer's investment.
That makes the moat concept crystal clear. Despite these massive public companies we'll discuss, the industry is still incredibly fragmented. What do the statistics tell us about just how fragmented it is?
The numbers are quite striking and, frankly, a bit counterintuitive given the scale of the public players. As of 2024, there are nearly 17,000 franchised light vehicle dealerships in the United States.
17,000, okay.
But here's the kicker. The 10 largest dealership groups, the ones you hear about on financial news, own a mere 9.3% of these locations. Just under 10% for the top 10.
Wow, that's way less than I would have guessed.
Right. And a staggering 92% of all dealers own between 1 and 5 stores, mostly small operators. This high degree of fragmentation is precisely why the report concludes there's a long and attractive runway for continued consolidation. There's a huge, untapped pool of smaller independent dealers that are potential acquisition targets for the larger players.
So this M&A trend isn't slowing down anytime soon.
Doesn't look like it. There's just too much room for it.
That leads us right into the transformative consolidation wave you mentioned earlier. It's a seismic shift for the industry. How active has this M&A frenzy been? And what are the strategic reasons behind it? What's driving this hunger for acquisitions?
Oh, the M&A activity has been unprecedented, frankly mind-boggling. Over the past 3.5 years, more than 2,000 dealerships have been acquired.
2,000?
That's nearly double the historical average transaction rate. And 2024 was a record year, with 438 completed transactions involving 510 dealership rooftops. It's truly a frenetic pace, like a land grab.
So why? What's the strategy?
The strategic impetus behind this is twofold. First, the pursuit of regional dominance. Larger groups are acquiring clusters of stores in specific geographic markets to establish significant market power. This allows them to optimize inventory management across multiple locations, enhance pricing leverage, and cross-sell services more effectively within a region, creating what the report calls super regional players.
Like owning the whole car market in one city.
Pretty much. Think of it as owning the entire automotive ecosystem, sales, service, parts in a given metropolitan area. The second impetus is operational efficiency. Scale allows these larger groups to centralize back office functions like IT, human resources, and marketing, driving down overhead costs per dealership. They can also negotiate more favorable terms with vendors and lenders because they're buying in bulk. It's all about leveraging size to gain a formidable competitive edge, squeezing out every bit of profitability.
It sounds like the big players are just buying up everything in sight. But has the landscape of acquirers shifted at all recently? Are the same companies always at the table?
It definitely has, and it's a fascinating dynamic. While large public companies like Lithia Motors have historically been extremely aggressive consolidators, their pace actually tempered in mid-2024.
Oh, really? They pulled back?
Yeah, a bit. They've shifted some focus toward divesting underperforming assets to optimize their portfolios, a kind of spring cleaning, if you will. This strategic pause, surprisingly, created a significant opportunity for private, family-owned groups. These private buyers have now emerged as the dominant force in the M&A market.
The private group stepped in.
They sure did. They accounted for nearly half of all buy-sell transactions and acquired a whopping 95% of all dealerships sold in 2024.
95%? Wow. Why the shift?
Well, this divergence is quite telling. It could suggest differences in valuation expectations, maybe risk tolerance, or strategic priorities between public companies, which are accountable to quarterly earnings and shareholder demand.
Right, the quarterly pressure.
And private groups, which might have longer time horizons or different financial structures, they can play a longer game. The result is what the report describes as a barbell industry structure. On one side, you have these large, sophisticated public and private groups leveraging scale and data. On the other, you have thousands of smaller, often family-owned dealers who might lack succession plans or the capital needed for OEM-mandated upgrades or expensive technology investments.
Making them prime targets for acquisition.
Exactly. This latter group forms a continuous and motivated pool of sellers, perpetually fueling the M&A pipeline. It's a constant churn.
That paints a very clear picture of the market structure. Now let's talk about the core of the business, the new versus used vehicle marketplace. How do these two segments compare within the dealership model, and what's their individual significance?
They're both critical but distinct. By unit volume, the used vehicle market is substantially larger, typically accounting for about 3/4 of all vehicle sales in the U.S. each year. So more used cars are sold than new ones.
Okay, 3 out of 4 are used.
Right. However, new vehicles, with their higher transaction prices, generate the largest component of a dealership's total revenue. Makes sense, they cost more. New vehicle sales have rebounded post-pandemic, but still remain below pre-pandemic levels. For 2025, forecasts are converging around 15.6 million units.
15.6 million.
Which is actually revised downward from earlier, more optimistic projections due to persistent affordability challenges for consumers and the potential impact of new import tariffs on vehicle prices. People are just finding it harder to afford new cars.
And what about that unusual period of profitability we saw during and right after the pandemic when prices seemed to go through the roof? How is that reversing now?
Oh, yeah. The period from 2021 to 2023 was an absolute anomaly for dealership profitability. Severe inventory shortages meant dealers had unprecedented pricing power, leading to record-high gross profits.
People were paying sticker or more.
Absolutely. Customers were paying sticker price, sometimes even over sticker, just to get a car. It was a true seller's market. But as global supply chains have healed and inventory levels have normalized, this trend has sharply reversed, leading to significant margin compression. The easy money from scarcity is gone, and the market is rebalancing. Back to reality.
So profits per car are down.
Significantly. The data really highlights this. The average gross profit per new vehicle retailed, or PVR, for publicly owned dealers was an estimated $3,298 in Q4 2024. While this marked the first rise in 7 quarters, it's still far, far from the pandemic peaks. Used vehicle gross profit has been more stable, settling around $528 per unit. This ongoing normalization of vehicle margins is a primary headwind for dealership earnings right now.
So inventory levels must be a crucial indicator of the industry's current health. What do those numbers tell us about the supply-demand balance right now, and what are the direct impacts on dealerships?
They tell us things are returning to normal, but normal now brings different pressures for dealers. New vehicle inventory on dealer lots stood at 2.76 million units at the beginning of October 2024.
Okay, getting back up there.
Yeah, that's up 25% year over year, which is good for consumers looking for choice, but it's still 20% below 2019 levels, so not quite fully back. The day's supply metric, which indicates how long it would take to sell all current inventory at the recent sales pace, reached 81 days in early October 2024. This closely mirrors the pre-pandemic norm of around 80 days.
81 days. So back to normal inventory turn times.
Pretty much. Now, this return to normal inventory is a double-edged sword. On one hand, it alleviates the vehicle shortages that constrain sales volume so customers can find the cars they want. Good for sales volume. But on the other, it shifts pricing power decidedly back to the consumer. This forces dealers to offer discounts and incentives, directly compressing those gross margins they enjoyed during the pandemic. Haggling is back.
And there's a cost to holding that inventory too, right?
Absolutely. And here's a crucial, often unseen cost, floor plan financing. Think of it like a revolving line of credit that dealerships use to buy cars from the manufacturers and keep them on the lot. They don't just pay cash up front for hundreds of cars. So in this higher interest rate environment, every single car sitting on their lot becomes more expensive to hold, essentially. The interest payments on that floor plan debt eat directly into their bottom line, even before a car is sold. That's a direct headwind to profits. It costs money every day a car sits there.
That makes it incredibly clear. Given all of this, you call the auto retail industry a quintessential cyclical industry.
Mm-hmm.
How sensitive is it to broader macroeconomic indicators, and why is that particularly important for investors to grasp?
It's highly sensitive because vehicles are expensive, durable goods that are overwhelmingly financed. You don't usually buy a car with cash from your pocket.
Right. Most people take out loans.
Exactly. So their sales are tightly correlated with key macroeconomic indicators like employment rates, consumer confidence, and most critically, interest rates.
Mm.
To give you a stark picture of this sensitivity, during economic downturns, the production of vehicles, what we call real motor vehicle output, on average, plummets almost 12 times more severely than the overall economy.
12 times more. Wow, that analogy really drives it home, like a small boat in a storm.
It really is. Imagine the difference between a ripple barely disturbing a large ship versus a huge wave capsizing a smaller boat. The auto industry is that smaller boat in an economic storm. It feels the swings much more intensely.
And you mentioned interest rates as being particularly critical. I mean, we all feel the pinch when rates go up on our mortgages or credit cards. But how specifically does that ripple through to something as seemingly distant as buying a car and then directly impact the dealerships themselves?
They hit the industry through two primary channels. First, higher rates increase the monthly payments for consumer auto loans. Pretty straightforward.
Makes cars less affordable.
Exactly. This directly affects vehicle affordability for you, the buyer, and thus dampens overall demand. People just can't afford as much car as they used to, or they put off buying altogether. Second, and equally important for dealers, higher rates increase the cost of their floor plan financing, which we just discussed. This directly increases a dealership's operating expenses, making it more expensive to simply keep cars on the lot.
So they get hit twice.
Yeah.
Less demand from buyers, higher costs for themselves.
Precisely. Hit on both the demand side from consumers and the cost side for their inventory. It squeezes them from both ends.
Beyond the economic cycles, are there also typical seasonal patterns in vehicle sales and service that dealerships anticipate and plan for?
Yes, very much so. It's quite predictable. Sales volumes typically peak in the spring months from March through May.
Tax refund season?
Often spurred by more favorable weather and, yes, the arrival of consumer tax refunds, that annual windfall. Then they pick up again in the fall from September through November, traditionally driven by the release of new model year vehicles and end-of-year sales events. Get the old models out, bring in the new. The winter months, particularly January and February, tend to be the slowest sales period. Fewer people want a car shop in the cold and snow.
And service follows similar patterns.
The P&S segment also exhibits seasonality, with demand for services like tire changes, inspections, and air conditioning checks peaking in the spring and fall. So dealers really live and die by these rhythms, planning staffing and inventory around them.
So even with all this cyclicality and seasonality affecting new and used car sales, the report points to the parts and service business as a powerful stabilizing force for dealerships. How does that work exactly, and why is that service absorption ratio so important?
This is a critical point for understanding dealership resilience. While new and used vehicle sales are highly cyclical, vehicle maintenance and repair are more non-discretionary expenses.
You have to keep your car running, right?
Pretty much. Think about it. During economic downturns, consumers often delay purchasing a new vehicle and instead invest in maintaining their current one to extend its life. This leads to more stable and sometimes even counter-cyclical demand for service and parts. People fix what they have instead of buying new. This inherent resilience makes the P&S department a critical anchor for dealership profitability through the economic cycle. It's like a consistent revenue stream when everything else is fluctuating wildly.
Okay, so P&S is the steady hand. What about that metric, the service absorption ratio?
Right. The report introduces a really important metric here called the service absorption ratio. This is arguably the single most important metric for evaluating a dealership's financial stability. It measures the percentage of a dealership's total fixed overhead expenses like rent, utilities, staff salaries that are covered by the gross profit from its P&S departments.
So how much of the basic bills are paid just by the service department?
Exactly. A high absorption rate signifies that the dealership can cover most or all of its fixed costs from the stable revenue stream, allowing it to remain profitable even if vehicle sales volumes decline sharply. For context, the industry average was 69.3% in the first half of 2024, meaning P&S covered nearly 70% of a typical dealer's fixed costs. That's a huge cushion against downturns in sales.
Almost 70%. That's incredibly stabilizing.
It really is. It's the key to their resilience.
Now let's shift our focus to the long-term secular shifts driven by technology and OEM strategies. These are described as the profound forces reshaping the industry, almost like a slow-motion earthquake.
Absolutely. Beyond the cyclical ups and downs, these are the fundamental changes that could alter the industry structure over the next decade. They challenge the very core of how cars are sold and serviced. It's not just about the economy anymore.
And the most direct challenge here seems to be the direct-to-consumer, or DTC, sales model, often associated with pioneers like Tesla. How does that directly challenge the traditional franchise dealership, which has enjoyed that regulatory moat you described?
This is truly the most direct challenge for the traditional franchise dealership model. As you mentioned, it was pioneered and perfected by EV native manufacturers like Tesla, who didn't have existing dealer networks to worry about. In the DTC model, the manufacturer completely bypasses the independent dealer network. This allows the OEM to control every single aspect of the customer journey, from initial browsing online to final delivery.
Cutting out the middleman.
Entirely. For consumers, this often offers transparent, often no-haggle pricing, and a streamlined online-first purchasing process. The whole experience can be digital, maybe even delivered right to your door. For the OEMs, the benefits are substantial. They gain complete control over vehicle pricing, direct ownership of the customer relationship, and all its associated data, which is gold in today's world.
That data is huge.
Absolutely. And they gain the ability to cultivate a consistent brand image without relying on third-party intermediaries. It's about total control from manufacturing to delivery and even after-sales service.
So how are legacy OEMs, the Fords and GMs of the world, and their established dealer networks trying to respond to this DTC threat, given that their hands are tied by those franchise laws? They can't just switch overnight.
No, they can't. So they're cautiously experimenting with what's called a hybrid agency model. In this setup, the dealer transitions from being a reseller, which is what they are traditionally, buying cars and selling them for a profit, to becoming an agent of the manufacturer.
An agent? Like a real estate agent?
Kind of, yeah. The OEM retains ownership of the vehicle inventory and sets a fixed, non-negotiable price for the car. So, no more haggling over the sticker price at the dealership level. The dealer's role then shifts significantly. They focus on facilitating the customer experience, providing test drives, explaining vehicle features, managing the final delivery, and crucially, performing all the service work. They become more like experience centers and service points.
And how do they get paid?
In return for these services, the dealer receives a fixed fee or commission per vehicle sold. This represents a fundamental change in the dealer's risk profile. They effectively trade margin risk for volume risk.
Okay, explain that. Margin risk versus volume risk.
Well, traditionally, dealers risked losing money if they had to discount cars heavily to sell them. Margin risk. In the agency model, the price is fixed, so that risk is gone. But now, their profitability becomes entirely dependent on the sales volume generated by the OEM's marketing efforts and whether that fixed fee is adequate. Volume risk.
So they need the manufacturer to sell lots of cars and pay them enough per car.
Exactly. This could lead to more predictable but potentially lower overall profits for the dealer and significantly increases their reliance on the OEM, giving the OEM even more power in the relationship.
But what's still defending the traditional model from a complete and rapid shift to these new agency models or DTC? Is that regulatory moat still holding strong?
It is, yes. For now, anyway. The primary bulwark, as we discussed earlier, remains those powerful state franchise laws. These regulations, which have been in place for nearly a century, create significant legal and political hurdles for legacy OEMs wishing to disintermediate their existing dealer networks. It's not easy to just dismantle that system legally. While EV startups have successfully challenged these laws in several states, allowing direct sales in some places, a complete federal overhaul is considered highly unlikely in the near term.
So the laws offer protection, at least for a while.
They provide a crucial protective buffer for incumbent dealers, buying them time to adapt and evolve rather than being swept away overnight. But the pressure is definitely building.
Speaking of EVs, let's talk about what the report calls the most significant long-term technological disruption, electrification, and its impact on that crucial parts and service revenue. What's the conventional wisdom or the bearish thesis about EVs and service, which really worries investors? What's the fear?
The conventional wisdom and the bearish thesis for investors is that EVs pose a severe threat to the P&S department because they have far fewer moving parts than ICE vehicles. There's no internal combustion engine, so no oil changes, no fluid flushes, no spark plug replacements, and no complex exhaust system maintenance. All that routine profitable work just evaporates.
Less stuff to break, less stuff to fix.
That's the basic idea. The expectation has been that this will drastically reduce the frequency of maintenance visits over the vehicle's lifetime, leading to a significant erosion of this high-margin, stable profit center for dealerships. It's seen as a fundamental threat to their most reliable revenue stream.
That makes intuitive sense. Less moving parts means less to break, less to service. But the report presents a more nuanced counter-narrative. What's that about? Is there more to the story of EV service than just less maintenance?
Well, what's truly remarkable here is that current real-world data is starting to show a different picture, at least for the medium term. While maintenance frequency may indeed decrease, the complexity and cost of EV repairs are proving to be substantially higher than for ICE vehicles.
Higher cost per repair? Really?
Yes, significantly higher. Publicly traded dealer groups have reported this consistently. For example, Asbury Automotive Group reported an average repair order for a battery electric vehicle, or BEV, of $865 compared to just $507 for an ICE vehicle.
Wow, that's a big difference.
And Penske Automotive Group cited an even starker difference. $1,300 for a BEV repair versus $700 for an ICE vehicle, almost double.
Why is so much more expensive?
This premium exists because of the advanced technology in EVs. They involve complex battery systems, high-voltage electronics, and incredibly sophisticated software. Servicing these components requires specialized diagnostic equipment and highly trained technicians. It's not just about turning a wrench anymore, it's about advanced diagnostics, electrical expertise, and understanding complex computer systems. That specialized knowledge and equipment comes at a price.
So this complexity actually creates a new competitive advantage, a new moat maybe, for franchise dealers themselves,
yeah,
given their ties to the OEMs.
Exactly. That's the counter-narrative. This complexity creates a new competitive moat in service. Independent repair shops may lack the substantial capital needed to invest in the required training and expensive equipment, or they might not have access to proprietary OEM software, which makes it very difficult for them to compete effectively in the EV repair market.
So the dealer service department might get a bigger slice of the repair pie.
Potentially, yes. This could allow franchise dealers with their OEM backing and resources to capture a larger share of EV service work, potentially offsetting the lower frequency of visits with higher revenue and margin per visit. It's a strategic shift from routine maintenance to complex repairs.
And how quickly is this happening?
Well, the pace of EV adoption also provides a window. J.D. Power projects EV retail share to be 9.1% in 2025, rising to 26% by 2030. That's significant growth, but it's still gradual. This gives dealers time to adapt their service operations, train their technicians, and invest in the necessary infrastructure. They have some breathing room.
But there's another threat looming, right? Over-the-air updates.
Yes. The ultimate long-term threat, which is still on the horizon, isn't necessarily mechanical. It's over-the-air OTA software updates. As vehicles become more like computers on wheels, a growing number of issues can be diagnosed and fixed remotely via software patches sent directly from the OEM, bypassing the dealership's service bay entirely.
So the car fixes itself, basically.
In some cases, yes. This could potentially disintermediate the dealer from a growing category of high-margin software-related service work down the road. That's a real long-term concern.
That's a huge shift from physical repairs to remote updates. Beyond the direct sales and easy impact, the report also highlights how digitalization has irrevocably altered the consumer's purchasing journey, a trend massively accelerated by the pandemic. What are these evolving consumer expectations that dealers now must meet? What do buyers want now?
Consumers now expect the ability to perform significant portions of the vehicle transaction process online. This includes everything from browsing inventory and comparing prices to applying for financing and valuing their trade-in vehicle.
They want to do it all from their couch.
Pretty much, or at least a large part of it. Market data supports this. The report suggests that the revenue share of purely physical dealerships is set to decline from 80% in 2023 to 70% by 2032, with hybrid online physical models capturing that difference. The purely traditional dealership model is shrinking its footprint in the overall revenue pie, so adapting is no longer optional. It's table stakes.
So how are forward-thinking dealership groups approaching this challenge? Are they just putting their inventory online, or is it something far more integrated?
It's far more sophisticated than that. They're not viewing this as a battle between online and in-person sales. Instead, it's about creating a seamless omni-channel experience.
Omni-channel, meaning connecting online and offline.
Exactly. This integrated approach allows a customer to begin their purchasing journey online, save their progress, perhaps get pre-approved for financing, and then visit a dealership for a test drive and final consultation without having to repeat steps or re-enter information. This fusion of digital convenience and physical interaction has been shown to dramatically improve customer satisfaction. It's about meeting the customer wherever they are in their buying process, letting them flow effortlessly between digital and physical touchpoints.
That sounds like a massive technological undertaking. What are the challenges and implications of implementing such an omnichannel strategy, especially for smaller dealers? Can they keep up?
It requires substantial and ongoing investment in technology. We're talking about sophisticated dealer management systems, or DMS, customer relationship management, or CRM platforms, advanced data analytics capabilities for inventory management and demand forecasting, and user-friendly digital retail tools. It's expensive.
Creates another advantage for the big guys, then.
Absolutely. This high cost of entry creates a significant scale advantage for the larger public and private dealer groups. They can afford to develop proprietary platforms such as Lithia's Driveway or AutoNation's Digital Storefront and deploy them across hundreds of locations. This allows them to amortize the investment over a larger base and create a superior, consistent customer experience that smaller, independent dealers simply struggle to match. This growing technological gap is yet another powerful force accelerating industry consolidation as smaller players find it harder to compete on the tech front.
And cybersecurity becomes a bigger issue too, I imagine.
Definitely. The industry's deep reliance on these complex, often third-party systems was starkly illustrated by the CDK Global Cyber Incident in June 2024, which crippled operations at thousands of dealerships and highlighted the significant operational and financial risks associated with cybersecurity vulnerabilities. It showed just how fragile their digital backbone can be if not managed properly.
Okay, let's transition to the specific players dominating the North American auto retail landscape. The report lists a handful of them. Lithia Motors, Penske Automotive Group, AutoNation, Group One Automotive, Asbury Automotive Group, Sonic Automotive, and Auto Canada. They all share a common business model fundamentally, but what are some of their distinct strategic bets and how do they differentiate themselves in the market?
That's a great question because while they all sell cars, their approach to the market and their internal financial makeup can differ significantly. A common hallmark across these companies is their diversified business model, but understanding the composition of their revenue and, more importantly, their gross profit truly reveals each company's core profit drivers. It tells you where the money really comes from.
Right, revenue versus profit.
Exactly. Let's take Sonic Automotive's 2024 results as a vivid example. New vehicles and used vehicles accounted for a combined 82% of their total revenue, 46% from new, and 36% from used. That's most of the sales dollars.
Okay, 82% from selling cars. Makes sense.
But here's the twist. When we look at gross profit, these vehicle sales contributed a mere 26% of their total gross profit, just 18% from new and 8% from used.
Only a quarter of the profit from over 80% of the revenue.
Precisely. In stark contrast, their higher margin fixed operations, which is parts and service and finance and insurance segments, despite generating only 18% of revenue, contributed a massive 74% of total gross profit.
74%.
Yeah, that's 42% from fixed ops and 32% from F&I. This dramatic divergence clearly underscores the critical role of these ancillary businesses in driving overall profitability for the entire peer group. They are, in essence, becoming finance and service operations that happen to sell cars alongside.
That 74% contribution from P&S and F&I is really stark. It almost reframes what a dealership is, doesn't it? It's not just about moving metal.
It absolutely does. It shows where the consistent, high-margin earnings are generated.
Given that fundamental profit driver, how does something like their geographic footprint play into their overall resilience and strategy? Are they focusing domestically, or is international diversification a key hedge?
Geographic diversification is a key strategic differentiator among them. Penske and Group One, for example, have significant international exposure. Penske operates extensively, not just in the U.S., but also in the U.K., Germany, Italy, Spain, and Australia. Group One has a major presence in the U.S. and the U.K., with the U.S. accounting for 77.4% of its new vehicle unit sales in 2024.
So they're spread out globally. Benefits. Risks.
Well, this international footprint provides diversification against a downturn in any single economy, which is good, but it also exposes them to currency exchange rate risk and different regulatory environments, adding layers of complexity. Swings in the euro or pound can impact their reported earnings. In contrast, Lithia, AutoNation, Asbury, and Sonic are primarily focused on the U.S. market, though they have varying regional concentrations within the U.S.
And Auto Canada.
Auto Canada, as the name suggests, is focused on its domestic market and is actually in the process of divesting its remaining U.S. operations to streamline its focus purely on Canada. So, different strategies there.
And their brand diversification. Does the mix of luxury versus mass market brands impact their margin profile and resilience, or is it all pretty similar at that scale?
Oh, it absolutely impacts them. The brand mix in a dealer's portfolio is a crucial determinant of its margin profile and cyclical resilience. Penske Automotive Group, for instance, is heavily weighted toward premium and luxury brands. Think BMW, Mercedes, Porsche.
Higher price tags, higher profits per car.
Generally, yes. While these typically offer a higher gross profit per unit, they can also be more sensitive to economic downturns, as luxury purchases are often more discretionary. People cut back on luxuries first. AutoNation and Asbury, by comparison, maintain more balanced portfolios with significant representation across domestic, import, and premium luxury segments. Think Ford, Toyota, and Lexus. This provides a hedging strategy against shifts in consumer preference or economic cycles. They're less exposed to any one segment.
So a mix can be safer.
It can be. And a portfolio heavy in, say, domestic truck and SUV brands, while benefiting from strong demand in those segments currently, might face lower overall margins compared to a luxury-focused peer, even if volume is high. It's about balancing risk and reward within their brand mix.
That's a really interesting point. What about their real estate strategies? Do they own their dealerships or do they lease them? And what are the implications of that choice for their balance sheet and overall value? Does it matter who owns the land?
It matters quite a bit. A dealer's approach to its real estate portfolio has profound implications for its balance sheet, capital allocation, and ultimately its valuation. Owning properties provides a stable operating base, protection against escalating lease payments, and a tangible asset base that can be used as collateral or even monetized later. Sell the land if times get tough. AutoNation, for instance, owns a significant portion of its real estate with a net book value of $2.8 billion as of year-end 2024.
Almost $3 billion in property value.
Yes. This owned real estate can represent a hidden asset that may not be fully reflected in the company's market valuation based just on earnings multiples. It provides a hard asset floor if the underlying business struggles.
Okay. So owning gives stability in asset value. What about leasing?
Conversely, a strategy of leasing properties, as pursued by Sonic for a significant number of its locations, creates a more capital-light model.
Frees up cash for other things.
Exactly. This frees up capital that can then be deployed into higher return activities like acquisitions, potentially boosting return on invested capital. Less money tied up in buildings means more money for buying other dealerships. However, it also creates higher operating leverage. Lease payments are fixed costs and exposes the company to the risk of rising rental costs over time, which can eat into margins.
So trade-offs either way.
Definitely. A thorough analysis really requires a sum-of-the-parts approach that separately values the operating business and the underlying real estate assets to get an accurate picture of their true value, especially for those who own a lot.
That makes a lot of sense. Let's refer to the data table provided in our sources now and pull out some key comparative insights on their operational and financial performance. For someone like me who follows the industry but isn't an accountant, what are the most telling metrics and what do they really tell us about how these companies are performing relative to each other?
Okay, the table offers a really clear snapshot and it immediately reinforces what we just discussed about profit drivers. Let's look at the gross profit mix, particularly for P&S and F&I. We can see consistently high percentages across the board for these crucial segments, validating their importance to the business model. AutoNation shows 41.0% from P&S and 28.5% from F&I. Group 1 is similar with 42.1% from P&S and 25.6% from F&I. Asbury has 43.1% from P&S and 27.3% from F&I.
And Sonic.
And Sonic Automotive, as we highlighted earlier, attributes 42% of its gross profit to P&S and a massive 32% to F&I.
So consistently, around 70% or more of gross profit comes from those non-sales areas.
That's right. This strongly reinforces how important these ancillary businesses are to overall profitability for all these companies. They are the engines of stable, high-margin cash flow.
What about growth from existing stores?
Right. Let's look at SSSG, or same-store sales growth, in Q2 2025. This tells us how much growth existing dealerships are seeing, stripping out the impact of new acquisitions. Group One really stands out with a healthy +7.1%. Asbury also showed strong organic performance at +5.0%, and Sonic's franchised operations were up +6.0%.
So they're growing internally, not just by buying.
Exactly. These numbers suggest strong execution in their existing stores. They're managing to grow the business they already have.
And F&I performance per car.
Yes. Moving to F&I PVR, which is finance and insurance gross profit per vehicle retailed, in Q2 2025. Sonic Automotive is a clear leader here at $2,718 per unit.
Over $2,700 per car just from finance and insurance.
Yep. This indicates exceptionally strong execution in this high-margin area, meaning they are very effective at selling financial products and insurance add-ons with each vehicle. They've really mastered that aspect of the sale. Others are lower, but still substantial.
And cost control. Who's running leanest?
Okay, finally, looking at SG&A as a percentage of gross profit over the last 12 months. This is a key measure of cost control, essentially. How much of their gross profit they keep after paying for overhead, like salaries, rent, marketing. Lower is better here. Asbury and Group One appear to be among the most efficient operators based on this metric. Asbury's SG&A was 64.4% of gross profit, and Group One's was 67.2%.
Meaning they keep about 35% and 33% respectively as operating profit before interest and taxes.
Roughly, yes. This means they're keeping more of their gross profit from operations, which directly boosts their net profitability. They manage their expenses well relative to the profit they generate. And while the specific service absorption data for public companies isn't in this particular table, we know the industry average was 69.3% in H1 2024. This just reminds us how crucial that metric is, as it shows how much of a dealership's fixed overhead is covered by their most stable revenue stream, P&S.
That really brings the numbers to life and clarifies what those metrics signify. So given these benchmarks, how do these groups pursue growth? Is it primarily through acquisitions, or are there other organic initiatives at play? How do they get bigger?
It's a mix, definitely a mix, but the emphasis can differ depending on the company's strategy and maybe their current financial position. For acquisitive growth, Lithium Motors is truly the sector's most prolific consolidator. It's core to their identity. They have an explicit strategy to grow via acquisition and network optimization. In 2024 alone, Lithia acquired 146 stores, investing $1.1 billion and adding an anticipated $5.9 billion in annualized revenue.
$5.9 billion in added revenue in 1 year.
That's massive, but so, buying another large company.
It really is. They are constantly buying. Asbury has also made significant strategic acquisitions, notably the pending $1.34 billion purchase of Herb Chambers dealerships and the completed acquisition of Jim Koons, which significantly expanded its geographic footprint and luxury brand mix. So others are active too, just maybe not at Lithia scale consistently. Okay, so buying is big. What about growing from within? Organic growth.
Right. Organic growth, through what the report calls adjacencies, is also becoming crucial. Dealers are investing heavily in these initiatives as key differentiators, creating new revenue streams from within their existing structure or related areas. For example, in digital platforms, we mentioned Lithia's Driveway and Asbury's ClickLane. These are proprietary e-commerce platforms designed to create that seamless omnichannel buying experience we talked about. They capture customers who prefer to transact online, integrating the physical and digital, and trying to build brand loyalty beyond just the dealership name.
What else besides digital?
Then there are standalone used vehicle stores. To compete with national players like CarMax, several groups have launched their own used-only brands, such as AutoNation USA and Sonic's Echo Park. These operate with a different cost structure and business model than traditional franchise dealerships, focusing purely on the high-volume used car market, often with no haggle pricing. It's a different approach to used cars.
Trying to beat CarMax at their own game.
Essentially, yes. And finally, perhaps one of the most interesting strategic moves is captive finance arms. Lithia's Driveway Finance Corporation, or DFC, and AutoNation Finance are strategic initiatives to internalize the highly profitable auto lending process.
So they're becoming the bank, too.
Exactly. By originating their own loans, these companies can capture additional profit that would otherwise go to third-party lenders like Chase or Capital One. They also increase customer retention. You finance with them, maybe you service with them, and gain valuable data on consumer credit behavior.
And is it working?
It seems to be gaining traction. Lithia's DFC, for instance, achieved its first full year of profitability in 2024, a significant milestone demonstrating the potential of this strategy to add substantial, recurring profit streams over time. It takes time to build scale, but the potential payoff is large.
It's clear they generate a lot of cash flow from all these diversified efforts. How do these companies manage that substantial free cash flow they generate? What are their capital allocation philosophies, and what does that tell us about their confidence in the future? Where does the money go?
The ability to generate robust free cash flow gives these companies a flexible approach to capital allocation. It's a good problem to have, deciding what to do with the profits. The primary decision for management teams is how to balance reinvestment in the business through acquisitions and capital expenditures for things like facility upgrades or tech, with returning capital to shareholders, either through dividends or stock buybacks.
So grow the business or give money back to owners?
That's the basic choice. Most U.S. public dealers have robust share repurchase programs. They view their own stock as an attractive investment, particularly given the sector's historically low valuations we'll talk about. For example, AutoNation repurchased $460 million of its stock in 2024, while Lithia repurchased $366 million. This signals management's belief that their stock is undervalued, and they see a good return by buying it back, which also boosts earnings per share for remaining shareholders.
What about dividends? Direct cash payouts?
Penske, on the other hand, has a long track record of consistently increasing its dividend, signaling confidence in its stable cash flow generation and a commitment to direct shareholder payouts. They returned a total of $351.9 million to shareholders in 2024 through a combination of dividends and buybacks.
So different approaches there.
Yes, slightly different emphasis. But the scale and consistency of these capital return programs, whether buybacks or dividends, are important indicators of management's confidence in future earnings and their commitment to shareholder value. They're putting their money where their mouth is, signaling they expect the cash to keep flowing.
Let's shift now to the investor's perspective.
Yeah.
Given all the strengths and strategies we've discussed, the moats, the profits from service, the growth, why does the market seem to persistently undervalue these companies compared to the broader economy? Seems like such a disconnect. Why so cheap?
It's a persistent question for investors looking at the sector, and it's something the report dives into deeply. You're right, the North American auto dealership sector has historically traded at a significant valuation discount compared to the broader market. If we look at the data, the auto vehicles, parts and service retailers industry traded at a median enterprise value to EBITDA multiple of 7.32x as of mid-2025.
7 times earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, amortization. Okay.
Right. Now compare that starkly to the S&P 500, which has recently traded at a price-to-earnings ratio of over 25x. That's a huge gap, meaning investors are willing to pay significantly less for a dollar of dealership earnings than for a dollar of average S&P 500 earnings.
So what are the market's reasons for this persistent valuation gap? Why are these companies valued so much lower, despite their apparent profitability and resilience in some areas? What's the hang-up?
The market prices in several key factors, which are essentially investor anxieties or perceived risks. First is high cyclicality. As we discussed, the industry's deep sensitivity to economic cycles makes its earnings stream inherently more volatile and less predictable than that of the average S&P 500 company. Investors generally prefer stability and predictability, and this sector historically lacks it on the sales side. They discount it for that bumpiness.
Okay, cyclicality is one.
Second is capital intensity. The business model requires significant capital for inventory, that expensive floor plan financing we talked about, real estate, and OEM-mandated facility upgrades. These substantial capital requirements can be a drag on free cash flow conversion. Even if they generate cash, they need to spend a lot just to keep the business running and comply with manufacturer demands, which limits the cash available for shareholders or faster growth. It's a hungry business.
Makes sense.
Yeah. And third, which is perhaps the biggest overhang and contributes most to skepticism, is secular disruption risk. The market harbors deep-seated skepticism about the long-term viability of the franchise model due to the threats from direct-to-consumer sales models and the ongoing EV transition, especially the impact on service revenue.
So fears about the future.
Exactly. There's a lingering fear that the traditional dealership model might become obsolete or significantly less profitable, even with those strong state franchise laws in place, leading to a long, slow decline. Investors are wary of paying a high price for a potentially melting ice cube.
So this creates what the report calls a classic value versus value trap debate for investors. How does that play out in the investment community? Is it cheap for a reason or just cheap?
It really hinges on whether you believe the bullish or bearish narrative. The bullish argument is that these risks, DTC, EVs, are overstated or manageable. The regulatory moat provided by state franchise laws is durable and not going away anytime soon. And these companies are generating substantial free cash flow at very low multiples, making them fundamentally undervalued. They're a bargain that the market simply hasn't appreciated yet, maybe because it's not a glamorous tech story.
And the bears.
The bearish counterargument, however, is that the industry is in a state of managed, long-term secular decline, and those low multiples are an accurate reflection of deteriorating future prospects. It looks cheap, but it's a value trap, where the stock seems cheap but keeps getting cheaper because the underlying business is fundamentally challenged.
So the whole investment case hangs on which story you believe.
Pretty much. The investment thesis for the sector ultimately hinges on which of these narratives proves more accurate over the long term. It's a bet on resilience versus disruption.
That's a clear dilemma for potential investors. Let's look at how private M&A market valuations provide benchmarks for the intrinsic value of dealership assets. You mentioned those earlier. And what exactly is blue sky in this context?
Right. Looking at private deals gives us clues. In the private M&A market, valuations are often based on a multiple of earnings, plus the fair market value of the underlying real estate and other tangible assets. The intangible value, or goodwill, is commonly referred to as blue sky.
Blue sky. Like the value beyond the hard assets.
Exactly. It's essentially the value of the franchise itself, the right to sell Ford or Toyota cars in that market beyond the physical assets. It represents the earning power of that brand and its established customer base in that specific location. It's the premium paid for the profit stream.
And does that blue sky value vary?
Oh, dramatically. What's fascinating here is that blue sky multiples vary dramatically based on the desirability of the franchise brand, which serves as a proxy for its profitability and growth prospects. It's not one size fits all. A 2024 report from Kerrigan Advisors shows this clearly. A top-tier Toyota franchise commanded a blue sky multiple in the range of 7.0x to 8.0x adjusted earnings. A highly coveted Lexus franchise could fetch a multiple as high as 10.0x.
10 times earnings just for the franchise.
Yeah, for the really strong brands. But in stark contrast, a struggling Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep, Ram, or Nissan franchise was valued at a much lower multiple of 2.5x to 3.25x. This wide dispersion underscores that the intrinsic value of a dealership group is a direct function of the quality and strength of its brand portfolio. Owning a lot of high-demand brands makes a massive difference to your underlying value.
And the real estate plays a role, too.
Critically. The value of the underlying real estate provides a significant floor for transactions. Dealership properties are often located in prime commercial corridors with high-traffic, valuable land. The average value of dealership real estate has climbed by 51% since 2014, reaching an average of $13.9 million per location in 2024. Almost $14 million per store just for the property.
So even if the brand struggles, the land is worth something.
Exactly. This rising real estate value has actually helped to offset some of the decline in blue sky values from their post-pandemic peaks, keeping overall dealership enterprise values at historically high levels, even if the earnings multiples compress a bit. This really highlights the importance, again, of that sum of the parts, SOTP, valuation methodology. A simple blended multiple applied to the entire enterprise fails to capture the distinct value of the different components. The new vehicle franchise, the used vehicle operation, that high-margin P&S business, and the tangible real estate assets.
You need to break it down.
You really do. A more accurate valuation would assign a separate multiple to the earnings stream of each business segment and then add the appraised value of the owned real estate. Such an analysis could reveal significant hidden value, particularly for companies like AutoNation that own a large portion of their property, which might not be fully recognized by the market's simple multiples.
So looking forward, what are the key factors that will drive the valuation of these public dealership groups? And what specific events or trends could trigger a significant re-rating, either an expansion, meaning higher multiples, or contraction, lower multiples of the sector's valuation?
Well, the single most important valuation driver going forward is likely the sustainable through-cycle earnings power. Can they prove their earnings aren't just a function of the cycle?
Proving consistency.
Exactly. This is the demonstrated ability to generate consistent, predictable earnings and free cash flow across an entire economic cycle. Analysts and investors must normalize these earnings from the 2021-2023 record profits, which were artificially inflated by supply constraints, to a realistic sustainable base. It's about understanding their true earning potential over the long haul, not just during an anomaly like the pandemic shortage.
What else matters?
Another critical factor, especially for a sector defined by consolidation, is return on invested capital, or ROIC. How well are they spending that money on acquisitions? This measures how effectively management is deploying capital into acquisitions and organic growth initiatives. A company that consistently generates an ROIC that exceeds its weighted average cost of capital, or WAC essentially, they're making more money from their investments than it costs them to finance those investments, is truly creating economic value for its shareholders. It means their acquisitions and investments are genuinely paying off and not just empire building.
Okay, so sustainable earnings and smart investments. What could make the market like these stocks more or less? What are the catalysts?
Right. In terms of catalysts for a re-rating, either an expansion or contraction of the sector's valuation, several factors could play a role. For potential catalysts for expansion, getting higher multiples, we could see a soft landing for the economy that avoids a deep recession, easing fears about cyclicality. Successful and accretive integration of a large acquisition would boost confidence in the consolidation story.
Proof the model works.
Yes, and tangible evidence that the P&S business can profitably navigate the EV transition would also be huge, easing those long-term investor fears. Maybe showing strong EV repair margins, or perhaps a successful spin-off of real estate assets could unlock that hidden value we discussed, making the company's true asset base more visible and maybe attracting different kinds of investors.
And what could hurt their valuations?
On the flip side, potential catalysts for contraction or lower multiples include a severe macroeconomic downturn that crushes vehicle sales and confirms the cyclicality fears. A significant legal or legislative ruling that weakens state franchise laws would be an existential threat, likely causing a major derating as it dismantles their core competitive advantage. That's the nightmare scenario. Or simply data showing a faster-than-expected decline in P&S revenue due to EV adoption could also cause a reevaluation of the sector downwards, confirming the bearish thesis about long-term decline. It really depends on how these major trends unfold in the coming years.
That's a comprehensive look at the opportunities and the investor calculus. Now let's conclude with a clear-eyed look at the risks facing the industry and individual companies. What are the major systemic and industry-wide risks that every dealership group must contend with, no matter how well-run they are?
These are the macro-level risks that affect all players in the sector, kind of the background radiation they operate in. First, a macroeconomic downturn. As we've hammered home, it's a highly cyclical industry, so a significant recession leading to higher unemployment and lower consumer confidence would severely depress new and used vehicle sales, which are the primary revenue drivers for all dealerships. They are fundamentally tied to the health of the economy. Can't escape that.
Interest rates again.
Yes. Second, the interest rate and credit environment. The sector is acutely sensitive to monetary policy. Sustained high interest rates increase the cost of both consumer auto loans, hurting demand, and dealer floor plan financing, hurting their costs. And a tightening of credit standards by lenders could reduce the availability of financing for consumers, further constraining demand. If it's harder and more expensive to get a loan, fewer cars get sold. Simple as that.
And the big one, the franchise loss.
Third, and perhaps the most significant existential threat, is the erosion of state franchise laws. A successful federal or widespread state-level legislative push by OEMs to repeal or substantially weaken these laws would fundamentally undermine the dealer's role as the primary sales intermediary, paving the way for direct-to-consumer sales by the big manufacturers. This is the big one that keeps dealers up at night, potentially dismantling their entire business model.
Anything else systemic?
And finally, supply chain and geopolitical risks. The global nature of the automotive supply chain makes it vulnerable to disruption. Events such as geopolitical conflicts, the imposition of tariffs, natural disasters, or pandemics can significantly impact the production and availability of both vehicles and replacement parts, as vividly demonstrated by the recent semiconductor shortage. When the supply chain seizes up, dealerships have nothing to sell, no matter how strong demand is.
Beyond those broad systemic risks, what about company-specific and operational risks that could impact individual dealership groups, particularly the larger public ones? Risks they create themselves, in a way.
Exactly. These are risks tied more to execution and specific circumstances. For the large consolidators like Lithia and Asbury, a primary operational risk is acquisition integration risk. We talked about the benefits of M&A, but there are risks too. Failure to successfully integrate acquired dealerships, whether through overpaying for assets, failing to achieve projected cost synergies, or clashing with the existing culture of the acquired stores, can destroy shareholder value. It's not enough to buy. You have to integrate well, and that's hard work.
Relationships with manufacturers.
Critical. Manufacturer relationships. The relationship between a dealer and its OEM partners is symbiotic but often fraught with tension. Dealers are highly dependent on OEMs for inventory allocation, financial incentives, and the renewal of their franchise agreements. A deterioration in this relationship, maybe the OEM doesn't like how the dealer is running things, or cuts their allocation can severely impact a dealer's profitability and growth prospects. For example, the 2025 OEM Supplier Working Relations Index showed Toyota, Honda, and General Motors ranked highest in supplier sentiment, while Nissan, Ford, and Stellantis ranked lowest, indicating potential areas of friction between those OEMs and their dealers down the line.
Cybersecurity again.
Yes, another significant risk highlighted recently is cybersecurity vulnerability. The industry's heavy reliance on third-party dealer management system providers like CDK Global creates a systemic vulnerability. A major cybersecurity incident, like the one CDK experienced in June 2024, can halt sales, service, and parts operations across thousands of dealerships simultaneously, resulting in significant financial and reputational damage. It showed just how interconnected and potentially vulnerable the industry's digital infrastructure is.
And risks from their own new strategies.
Definitely. Execution risk on strategic initiatives. The success of future growth depends on the effective execution of new business ventures. A failure to profitably scale adjacent businesses, such as a captive finance arm like Lithia's DFC, or a standalone used vehicle brand like EchoPark, represents a significant risk to a company's long-term growth narrative, and could result in substantial impairment charges if they have to write down those investments. These big bets can either pay off handsomely or burn a hole in their balance sheet if they don't execute well.
And finally, what are the most fundamental long-term secular risks that could truly alter the industry's structure over the next decade, even if the economy is stable and they execute well? The slow burners.
There are two big ones here. First, the one we keep coming back to. The EV transition impact on P&S. This is the most widely discussed long-term risk. It's the potential for the EV transition to structurally impair the profitability of the parts and service segment. The reduced maintenance needs of EVs could lead to a permanent decline in the stable, high-margin revenue stream, which has historically been the most stable and profitable part of the dealership business. While our nuanced counter-narrative suggests higher repair costs might offset some of this, the overall volume of service visits over the long term is still a big question mark that worries investors about the sustainability of that profit center.
And the second one.
The other major long-term risk is OEM disintermediation through technology. Even if state franchise laws remain intact legally, OEMs can leverage technology to marginalize the dealer's role over time. They can chip away at the dealer's value proposition.
Awesome.
This includes the implementation of agency sales models, which reduce dealer control over pricing and the customer relationship. The use of over-the-air or OTA, software updates for vehicle diagnostics and repairs, bypassing service bays entirely for certain issues, and the development of direct data relationships with vehicle owners through connected car technology, cutting the dealer out of that information loop. All of these could allow OEMs to capture a greater share of the automotive value chain, effectively reducing the dealer to a lower margin delivery and service agent over time. This is a fundamental structural shift that could erode profitability over decades, slowly but surely, even without legislative changes.
All right, that was a truly deep dive. Phew. We've navigated the complex, cyclical, and definitely rapidly transforming world of the North American auto dealership sector.
Right.
From regulatory moats and consolidation ways to the double-edged sword of electrification and the imperative of omnichannel retailing, it's clear this isn't your grandparents' car business anymore. Not by a long shot.
No, it really isn't. What's fascinating here is how these seemingly stable entities, these fixtures in our communities, are adapting to profound technological and behavioral shifts. Understanding these dynamics helps us appreciate not just the investment landscape, but also the future of vehicle ownership itself. It's a testament to how even mature industries must continuously reinvent themselves to survive and thrive in the face of disruption.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? Next time you walk into a dealership or maybe even just browse cars online, you might notice things differently. Will your next car purchase be entirely online? Or will that human element, that test drive, that chat with a salesperson still be central? And will your EV require radically different service, or will it be a new kind of repair challenge handled by specialized techs?
The experience is changing.
Yeah, and this raises an important question. As the industry continues its evolution, how might the balance between convenience doing things online, maybe fixed prices versus the price you pay, versus the personalized touch you get from a local dealer, how might that balance shift? Will it shift in your favor as a consumer? Or perhaps will it present new challenges, maybe less transparency or fewer choices in some ways? It's definitely something to mull over as you consider your own next deep dive into the world of automotive retail.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We hope you feel far more informed and ready to spot those aha moments in the automotive world around you. Until next time, keep digging for those nuggets of knowledge.